ordered to reopen things in phase two, which is tentatively scheduled for June 20th. The governor wants to see 100,000 tests a week. But right now, the state is nowhere near meeting that. It's not due to lack of tests, but Governor Ned Lawn said there's not enough people wanting to get a test. The state does continue to encourage people to get tested, saying the more people who do so, the safer everyone will be, because the people who have it but aren't showing symptoms can stay home. Connecticut has also been working to make it easy as possible to get these tests. To talk about this a little bit further is the Dean of Health Services over at the University of New Haven, Dr. Summer Johnson McGee. Welcome back to the show, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, are you kidding me? I was looking forward to it. You were so fantastic last time we had you on. Why do you think this request is being ignored by so many people?
Well, I think in large part it's because the initial messaging around who should get a test and when should people get tested in the early days of this pandemic really told people, you know, the only people who should be getting a test are people who are showing symptoms, and we should be saving these tests for healthcare workers and first responders because the tests were scarce.
Mm-hmm.
Now we changed our tune a bit, and now we're trying to get everybody in the community to be able to get tested with some frequency. And I think that communication just hasn't caught up with the general public. And so what we're seeing is folks are still not really understanding who should be tested or at what level.
Well, then how do you motivate Connecticut citizens to take this test?
Well, I think you've got to get the word out there. I think you've got to have, you know, your local officials and your public health officials really getting that message out there that we do want the general public to be tested. I think another component of this is there has been some flip-flopping and confusion at the state level about what do you have to be or do to be eligible for a test. We rescinded an executive order that required a physician to actually order the test.
Yep.
And then we put that order back in place. That executive order removing that was rescinded. So now you actually do need to have a physician or a healthcare provider order to get tested. And so if you go on one of these websites to say, I'd like to get a test, if you don't have symptoms and you don't have a physician's order, they're telling you that you're not eligible for a test at this time. So I think that's not the message we want to be sending to the general public, and we need to fix that ASAP.
Well, then how can, therefore, the governor expect 100,000 people a week to get a test if they're not even eligible to be referred by a doctor for this test?
Well, that's the exact problem. And so I think that we need to take a hard look at whether that, you know, the executive order rescinding the first executive order should be rescinded again. I think we need to look at really doing some aggressive messaging and PR around you don't have to be symptomatic to get a test. We really need to start pushing that so that people understand. We need a general understanding of how many people in Connecticut have been exposed to this virus, not just for people with symptoms, not just first responders and healthcare workers.
And I completely agree with you, Doc. But isn't it also true where, let's say I go get tested today, okay? And I don't know how long it is. I heard 48 hours. Who knows? That was a couple of months ago. I don't know how long it takes now to get the results. Is it more than that or less than
that? It's about that. Depending on whether you can get a rapid test or whether you get a more standard test, it can be, you know, anywhere from, with a rapid test, it's 15 minutes. But if you're getting a standard test, it can be somewhere around 2 days.
Okay, so let's say I get the standard test. And then I go take this test and they tell you to go, what, self-quarantine for 48 hours? And I do that, and I get the phone call saying, okay, Mr. Byron, you are negative. Okay, so then I go back out, and theoretically, wouldn't I need a test every day? Because just because I'm negative up until that day that I took that test, that doesn't mean that going forward I can't contract it.
Well, yeah, sure. You certainly can be exposed at any point. And, you know, the incubation period of when people begin to really, you know, have a virus in their body so that the test would be positive really can vary from, you know, a week to 10 days. So The timing of those tests are really important. And you're right, if you're out in the community, you could potentially be exposed at any time. I think, though, that if you're abiding by social distancing and you're wearing your mask religiously, then I think your risk is much lower. And so you probably don't need to be tested daily, but you could be looking at being tested, you know, at least monthly, if not more frequently, depending on your risk level, what you do in your job, and how frequently you're interacting with others.
You know, that's an interesting point, because I had also heard, now again, this may be dated, maybe, and that's why I'm glad that you're on, that you can correct me on this. I heard that you can only have one test. Is that, has that also been rescinded, or was that coming down from the insurance companies, or does the insurance even cover this?
So these tests are being covered, and in a lot of cases, they're being made freely available to certain groups within the state, state workers and other groups. So, you know, there is certainly access, and we're not limiting the test to one time. I think many of the conditions for reopening many kinds of businesses, particularly in higher education, is that in the fall, we're going to be asked to test our residential students upon arrival to campus, and then again within 2 weeks after that. So we definitely are going to be doing multiple testing, and we need to do that because of the incubation period and the potential for both false negatives on the test, but also subsequent exposure.
You mentioned masks a moment ago. If you wear your mask religiously, do you find that people have more or less relaxed on that? That in the 6 feet of social distancing. Now that we're in the warmer weather, and people are outside, and they're eating restaurants out, and some of the stores have reopened. Have you noticed any relaxing of those self-imposed rules?
I have, and frankly, from the start of this, I really didn't see enough people, in my opinion, wearing masks. And taking that guidance seriously. And I live in West Haven, and I drove by the West Haven beaches last weekend, and I was stunned at the number of people I saw on the beach not wearing masks and not social distancing. And that concerns me. I'm really concerned that, you know, we are going to see a spike in cases in a couple of weeks from now as a result of reopening and the Memorial Day weekend, that we're going to see an increase in cases, which a certain increase we expected as a part of the reopening. Hopefully it's not a giant spike.
Yeah, and I was going to say that, because some of these other towns who are a little ahead of us with lifting some of these restrictions have already noticed that there has been a slight increase, a spike may be too strong of a word, but a slight increase in new cases of the coronavirus. But at the same time, we also have heard that if you're outdoors, you don't need to concern yourself as much as if you're indoors regarding wearing your mask.
It certainly is a higher risk environment to be indoors, where air is recirculating and that the natural breezes of being outside don't kind of pull those particles out of the air. It certainly is a higher risk environment to be indoors. But if you're outdoors and you're not socially distancing, and you have people who are talking or laughing or breathing heavy in your airspace, you still have that same risk as if you are inside. So I think it's important for people to not get a false sense of security of that, oh, I'm outside, I could do whatever I want. We still want people to be abiding by social distancing and wearing masks really in all situations, unless you're in your home around your family unit, because that's what we've seen has been most effective in preventing further spread of the virus.
You know, and maybe you can kind of dispel some of these rumors and, you know, some of the things I've read, or you and I both know you can't believe everything that you read online. In fact, I'll even say you can't really believe everything you see on TV or on news. So maybe we can dispel some of these. Okay, so is this airborne or not?
It is airborne. So aerosolized particles, water-based particles containing the virus in the air, it does travel through the air. So there's three main ways you can contract the coronavirus: direct contact with bodily fluids. You can get it through the air in aerosolized particles, and you can get it from surfaces, although the CDC recently revised their guidance and said, while you still potentially could get it from a surface, that's not the primary way that the virus is spread. So, you know, all the wiping down of our mail and our packages that we did so religiously for months and months, many of us did, that's not probably the primary way that it's being spread, but definitely through the air.
All right. So that was, you answered my next question as well, because I heard the same thing that the surfaces from the CDC, they're saying that it's very difficult, if not downright impossible, to catch it on surfaces. And you're right. You know, and listen, everybody is over disinfecting, right? I mean, more now than ever. So much so that Clorox can't keep up with the demand. All right. So, and I talked about the airborne. And let's go back to being outside again. And I think that's one of the reasons why the governor has lifted restrictions when it comes to dining outside at some of these restaurants, is because it's a lot harder to get. When you combine that with the increase of temperature now that we're here in June, isn't that more relevant now? Because we've heard all along that it really doesn't like the warmer temperatures. So when you combine that with being outside and in the warmer temperatures, is it true that it could minimize the amount of contracting of this disease?
Well, we know that heat as well as UV light degrades viruses and breaks them down, right? So there is some sense in which, you know, if the virus were on a surface in the sun, or whether it were in a really hot environment, there it's a less hospitable environment for that virus to be spread. I think how much of an impact we're going to see seasonally on this virus is still an open question. But again, I think that it seems to be the case that certainly sunlight and higher temperatures seem to be less favorable for the virus's spread than colder or non-sunny areas.
Okay, and then let's continue. Let's do another one here. In the fall, when temperatures, particularly here in Connecticut and the Northeast, most of the country actually, when the temperatures start to go down a little bit, where the temperature isn't 70 and 80, but more like 50 and 60. And they're predicting that this will come back in some way, shape, or form, that it can come back. I heard initially that it could come back worse, although I haven't heard that one in probably a couple of months, that's still going to come back, but it can come back at a less potent than it is right now. Any truth to that? Is there any possibility that it doesn't come back at all? Let's start with that. And then if it does, are you hearing the same things, or are you discovering for yourself that it can come back and less potent?
Yeah, I think that historically what we've seen is in these kinds of pandemics is that the second wave has historically been worse than the first. And so I think that the concern is that if we do see a relaxing of social distancing and mask wearing and some of these protections over the summer, that we could potentially have a much more serious spike of cases in the fall. And so historically that's been true. Whether that will happen with the coronavirus, we don't know. And so that's why everyone is really trying to get the word out to don't let your guard up. You know, this virus is never going to leave us. It may be really much less prevalent over the summer because of all the people who have stayed home and all the public health measures we've taken, but it is not going away. And we will always be having new cases until we have an effective vaccine. And so I think that's important for people to understand. And it's really individual human behavior that's going to determine in large part whether or not we see this next spike. So it really is kind of up to us to make sure that we do the right things and keep ourselves healthy and safe.
Yeah, well, that would mean, I mean, based on what you're saying, though, I mean, this sounds like it can go on indefinitely. And really, our way of life will not just be compromised this year. I think we're all looking at the light at the end of the tunnel. We'll forego 2020. We don't want to, but we kind of have no choice. And we're looking at 2021. I mean, you're talking about our entire way of life, people getting together for holiday parties and birthday parties and weddings and sporting events and graduations. And are you saying that next year could be a carbon copy of this year and going on indefinitely into the future?
Well, I think that it is very likely that we will see all of those large group gatherings and social gatherings and activities, everything from schools to weddings and, having to function differently until we get a vaccine. So if we get lucky and we have a vaccine within the next year, then our society will change. But for the foreseeable future, I think these kinds of modifications, limits on large gatherings and having to abide by social distancing, I think it's here to stay. And I know people don't like to hear that, but the price that we'll pay if we don't do that is what we just went through with 100,000 Americans dying. And so I think we've seen that the potential cost, if we don't take this seriously, could really be very high.
Then let's talk about a vaccination, because that begs the question. I mean, we've heard that it could take years to come up with a vaccination. Now, granted, it seems like on a global level, a lot of the scientists and epidemiologists have kind of put things off to the side and have really concentrated specifically on this COVID-19. So you have more eyes and more brains, I should say, working on this. And there seems to be some competitiveness between nations. Who's going to come up with the vaccination first? Which can be a good thing, of course, after all the tests have been performed. Could you realistically see a vaccination and I've heard it takes years, plural. Could you actually see a vaccination be introduced within a year?
You potentially could. I mean, if we hit upon the right delivery mechanism and the right combination of things, we potentially could. There's been some very promising early clinical trials that suggest that we're on to something here. But there are also scientists that have said that we may never have a vaccine for the coronavirus in the way that, we don't have vaccines for other coronaviruses that just circulate and give us colds and things, seasonally throughout the year. And so there's no guarantee, but I am encouraged by the early data that I'm seeing. And we may come up with effective treatments, which will also change how we think about it. So we may not have a cure in a vaccine, but we may identify in time some ways that even if you do get the virus and get sick, that you'll be able to recover much more quickly or not get nearly as sick at all. So there is certainly hope. But I think it we're in this for the long haul.
You said, I mean, coronavirus has been around for quite a while. What makes this particular strand of it be what it is?
Well, I think there's two things. I think one is that it's brand new and no human body on the planet had encountered this virus before. So no one who gets exposed to this virus has any sort of effective immunity against the virus. We've been exposed to all other kinds of strains of coronaviruses and can fight those off more or less effectively depending on our immune system. I think the other thing is that this virus in particular attacks certain receptors in the body, these ACE2 receptors, that are really plentiful in our lungs and in our gut and our gastrointestinal system. And it really has a number of very sophisticated ways of making us sick and cause a really wide range of symptoms. And so this is a virus that frankly is really smart at figuring out how to make the human body vulnerable. And so that's been very difficult for us to figure out how to make that virus less effective at doing that.
And I only have about 30 seconds left, so really.